what is equality. It's right, like, yeah. It's not saying we have to race the same distances. Like, you know, it's
equal
it's,
opportunity.
Exactly. And creating like a fun, exciting sport in the world where attention spans are so short, you need to be more extra packed for people to want to watch it. So yeah, like the world at the moment is in that kind of time where everyone wants to show these differences, create these different opportunities and inspire the younger generations. And, you know, if they can strive and say, we don't always have to fight just because we're girls, that we deserve this, it should be the norm.
It's showtime, everybody! Showtime!
You've been living in a dream world, Neo. Yeah. This is the world as it exists today.
Life moves pretty fast. You don't stop and look around once in a while. You could miss it.
Listen, we talking about practice.
Hey, Pete, on the dude's run.
Donnie, you're out of your element.
I see. You think this has nothing to do with you.
Don't ever trash talk Black Jesus.
This is the Adventure Stash with Payson McKelvin.
Howdy, everyone, and welcome back to the show. It's December, and this show is brought to you by SRAM. That's right. I sent them an email towards the end of November saying, hey, y'all, thank you so much for supporting all of the episodes in November. If you ever want to do this sort of thing again, if y'all felt it was of value, let me know. And they said, well, how about next week? How about all of December? And I was like, how about heck yeah? In all seriousness, SRAM, thank you for believing in this project. It's so awesome what a race heritage SRAM has. Obviously, that's something near and dear to my heart, but it's equally cool that they see value in these sorts of non-competitive projects and conversations. And in that regard, they are really such a dream partner because obviously we have similar values as well here at the Adventure Stash. As luck would have it, this week's guest, Tiffany Cromwell, races for a team whose title sponsor is SRAM, the Canyon SRAM Women's Pro Team, one of, if not the best, road teams in the world. Tiffany is an absolute killer on the bike, and it's so cool that SRAM stands behind this group of really, really badass women, a couple of whom I got to hang out with at the Steamboat Gravel Race last summer. And that's where we recorded this episode. Tiffany is an icon of the sport without a doubt, but she and I met on some other levels too. She's very passionate about fashion, which I'm not afraid to admit I have developed some interest in. I have an appreciation for culture and have been enjoying more and more time in cities the last couple of years. And so we talk about that some. So anyway, if y'all would, please stick around for some announcements at the end of the show. Enjoy this conversation with Tiffany Cromwell, one badass of an Aussie.
Alrighty. Have you been to Steamboat before? We're recording now. Yep. Have you been to Steamboat before?
No, this is actually my first time in Steamboat. I've been to Colorado plenty of times, but no, first time in Steamboat, so pretty cool to check out.
Yeah. And have you done the Colorado Classic?
No, actually, it's my first time for Colorado Classic as well, because I guess until now it hasn't been a UCI race. And
oh, it's first year UCI this year?
I believe so, yeah.
Really? Nice.
Yeah, so they always had the support event for the women, but it wasn't UCI, it's just the men's one was. And then this year they decided, obviously they got rid of the men's race and then put it all into the women's race and now trying to make it bigger and bigger. So super cool that Canyon SRAM have decided to come out to support the race.
Yeah. So how many major teams are, and do they, I'm sorry for my ignorance, but on the women's side, are there the same designations, World Tour, Pro Conti, Conti? Do they use the same structure?
We just have World Tour and non-world tour, so there's not the different levels, but you're not seeing the process of change to women's cycling at the moment, where there is a plan to develop it further, but I guess to have world tour and then professional then amateur, but for the moment it's you're either world tour or you're not.
So, gotcha.
Yeah.
And I saw Tibco's trailer out there. Yep. Are they world tour?
To be honest, no, I don't think they are. They're just a UCI registered team, but they just do their split program between the US and Europe and just get invites where they can. Because at the moment, it's, I think, races are only obliged to invite top 5 or top 10 ranked teams in the world, so World Tour or not, and then the rest is at their discretion. So I guess TIBCO seem to have a presence and get some good starts, but not necessarily all the big starts. But, you know, they do a good balance of the program between the US and Europe, which is great for anyone trying to get into the full-time European professional peloton.
Yeah, yeah. Roughly how many teams are there now for on the World Tour?
On the World Tour?
The big ones? Eight. Like, so who are your... your arch nemesis? There's obviously your Canyon SRAM.
Yeah.
Which was Specialized Lululemon.
So we can even go back further. So it's a complete new entity when it came about, but it more or less, a lot of the foundations came from originally like T-Mobile HTC. So Ronnie Lauka, who's our director and also the owner of the team, he was a director back then. Mm. From that, it became, when T-Mobile stopped, that became Specialized Lululemon for 3 years. And then when they stopped, this was when Christy Scrimmager was owning the team and Ronnie was still only a director. And then that stopped. Then Christy created Flotcho SRAM. Then we also had some issues like sponsors and struggled. Then she stepped out of the sport, well, out there having a team. And then Canyon came in, approached Ronnie and said, are you interested in, you know, we want to have a women's team. Do you want to get involved, own it? Yeah. So he, I remember when it started, like he never even thought about owning a team. It just kind of came about, and and then it came from that. But a lot of foundations, a lot of the staff have come, and some of the riders have come from those previous teams.
Right.
Yeah.
So you have Trek Segafredo, Bigla,
Bols Dolmans.
Or is it Bols Dolmans now?
No, Bigla is also another team.
Okay, yeah.
They're still one of the top teams, but they're still, I can see them like slightly smaller than the top in terms of stacked riders. Mm. So Bols Dolmans, Sunweb, Triple C, Liv. Movistar, FDJ. But again, FDJ is probably a step down, again, just because they don't have as big riders.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Same as like MTN Rota. Like they're a team, like they have a couple of very big riders, but also some young German riders too. So it's getting more and more, I'd say at the moment, there's probably about 10 really good teams you could go to and say, yeah, that's a team I'm happy to ride for.
Mm. They could win today.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then it drops off quite quickly, you know, in terms of the riders, the budgets, how they operate. But yeah, but it's moving in the right direction. There's a lot of excitement in women's cycling at the moment. Yeah. So.
And what I was kind of getting at there is, so all of those teams you named have a brother team.
Yeah.
Canyon SRAM doesn't have a brother team, right?
Exactly.
Is that, do the riders on the team take pride in that? Is that something that you think is cool, or would you rather have that partnership?
I think you can go both ways. Like, I personally think it's quite cool because, you know, to see a standalone women's team being as present and, you know, doing so well is pretty cool. And we don't have to rely on having the branding of, say, a big men's team and all their following to try and get, you know, bigger budgets and everything else. It means, you know, resources you can't share across, but Canyon SRAM have always been really professional in terms of we get the best, you know, they want the best, the highest technology, the fastest bikes, fastest wheels, all these things. And we're lucky we work with partners that want that too. So, you know, obviously Canyon, just because they also have Katusha and Movistar, doesn't mean they're not going to give us second-rate things. So we always get, like, you know, the latest equipment, stuff like that from them. And same with SRAM, you know, we've used a lot of the prototypes before. They've been released, like the 12-speed SRAM Red now, even the 11-speed when that came out, the disc brakes. So it's pretty cool that a team, a standalone women's team, can be at that level, the same level as, say, a lot of the men's professional teams.
Yeah.
Sure, okay, the budget isn't as big, but we also don't need the massive budget because it's not as big an organization with, you know, 28 riders and however many staff and everything else. But
yeah,
it's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, clearly Canyon does care a lot because they just flew you all the way over here to do this gravel race and the Colorado Classic later. Yeah. But it clearly they see you as very important ambassadors. And I see that. I mean, the Canyon SRAM team is like legendary.
Yeah.
Like it has a huge social media following.
Yeah.
And you seem like a fun group. I mean, some of the photos and videos that you've been posting with Ella here, you guys doing like a Superman on the bike. And actually, that's one thing that impressed me is I saw a couple of videos, now that I'm following you, I saw a couple of videos from this week where you're busting out a pretty sick skid and like doing a one-handed Superman down a gravel road and stuff. I was like, damn, this girl has some skills. Because coming from a mountain bike background, a stereotype that many mountain bikers have of road riders is that, they can get down a mountain descent and navigate a pack very impressively. But when it comes to like playing around on a bike and doing silly stuff like you were posting photos of, don't always have those skills. So is that something that you've consciously worked on, or do you just like to play on your bike? Like, where does that come from?
I think it's a mix. It definitely comes from where I enjoy playing, and I love the old party trick. And yeah, you know, being out here in for a gravel race and having fun bikes to play on is a perfect excuse to, you know, muck around. And yeah, at the end, big kid at heart. And I grew up, you know, on bikes, just muck around in the backyard in Australia. And so, yeah, I think from the get-go, I've always wanted to be able to do the skills. You know, I started on the velodrome. There we learned a lot of the basic skills, things as much as like a track stand. And I just always like to challenge myself further. It's like, okay, I can do a track stand. Great. What next? Track stand one hand, track stand no hands. Mm. Then I've always had a fascination for dirt. I haven't necessarily had too many opportunities to be able to do it, but I'm also a big believer in cross-training and cross-discipline, because I believe then you can be a more complete athlete, and so much can then cross over, say, into the road riding, for example. Like now we're seeing more and more dirt in road races, like Strade Bianche, for example, but that's known for the white roads, but, you know, the cobbles, and then we'll have dirt sectors. The race that the rest of the team did this weekend in Sweden, that had some dirt sectors. So, you know, to be able to have the handling skills makes a huge difference, because, as you say, so many road riders are terrible. And
maybe not terrible,
but not that great, you know, just the ability to let, you know, like the wheel drift out a little bit. And it takes, you know, a bit of mindset to allow that, because on the road, you think if you lose your tire, you're going down. But I've always loved mountain biking too, and play on the trails. And I think with that, how I've developed my skills with the dirt is just I throw myself in the deep end. I've always gone with people who are way better than me. Like, he's trained a lot in Adelaide with a guy who's like multiple-time Australian national champion.
Who's that?
Chris Jongewaard.
Yeah.
So he's a good legend. Friend of mine. Yeah. So he'd done a bunch of rides when I was younger, and then been in the south of France where I get so a couple off seasons ago, so I had the Canyon Hardtail, the Exceed mountain bike, and awesome bike, but not for the trails around there. Like, I need an enduro bike, so I'm going down on this hardtail. Like, I'm lucky it's full spec because it's one of Pauline's bikes, but with a guy who used to race World Cup mountain bikes, Julian Camellini, and another friend. So we're going down these things, and I'm just like, all right, let's go, let's just try to do this. And you know, if I don't crash, then it's awesome. So I've learned from there just how to position yourself, how to handle the bike, the feeling. And also, I've done some riding with Pauline as well, so I think it's just I enjoy the challenge, because for me, just doing one thing or just road riding, just something that's boring per se. Like, okay, road riding isn't always boring. There's lots of exciting things, but things that challenge me, my skills, I always enjoy that. And I always want to push the boundaries with that. And I think that's how I've developed all these fun skills. And it's always cool when you can throw a party trick of a Superman, you know. It's like, as long as I don't pull over, then all is good. And on the rare occasion it messes up, it's about finding your limits.
Yeah, for sure. So you mentioned Strade Bianche and just kind of the crossover there a minute ago. Within the Peloton, how impressed or surprised or not surprised were people when Annika Långvad finished second in that race this year?
Personally, I don't think people were surprised, because for sure she's a phenomenal athlete, you know, and coming from an endurance mountain bike background as well, you know, obviously she does short track and stuff, but also the marathon and being world champion and things like that. So, you know, it's not surprising at all, because she's got a huge engine and that's the race that kind of takes it. And I guess it was an awesome card that Bowles could play, because normally everyone looks at Anna van der Breggen and, you know, there are the strong riders, but it's like, well, they have this other card. And sure, at first people were like, is she going to be that strong in that length? Because, well, for me personally, I thought I was only thinking the XC starts. Like, sure, she'll be great, but mountain biking XC short track is short. It's like 1.5, 2 hours. Mm. But then it's like, oh, okay, she's actually marathon as well. So that's the engine and with the skill set as well. So it's cool, though. It's cool to see the cross-discipline. Like, you know, you've seen Yolanda Neff do it for a while. Obviously, Pauline.
Your teammate. Yeah, exactly. She's unbelievable. Her ability to cross over and just win at everything blows my mind.
Exactly. It's pretty incredible. And
she's the Vanderpool.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And you see the men too now as well. So, so it's cool. And it's cool to see more, I guess, mountain bike dirt athletes coming into the road as well. And then vice versa, seeing some road riders kind of dabbling in, you know, the dirt world and the gravel world.
Yeah. Yeah. So did you like your gravel experience yesterday here at Steamboat Gravel?
Yeah, I loved it, you know. As I said, you know, it's the first time doing a gravel race, and obviously Steamboat Gravel put on an awesome event. Like, we were fortunate enough that Canyon won us here, and obviously Steamboat Gravel wanted to get some, you know, I guess
high profile
names. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And from different disciplines to like bring more focus, and it's great. And you know, their push for parity as well, I think, is awesome as well. So you know, they've set the bar at a very high level for their first year, and I'm sure it will bring more people. But I had an absolute blast, you know, to be able to do something where it's, you don't have the pressure of like the performance that we get with the team, the tactics, you know, just to have, particularly because we're getting to the point in the season where it's getting pretty very business end, you know, we're working towards world championships, and just had this small kind of mental break, I guess you could say, to do something fun. But it's still hard because we raced 100 mile or 160K at 2,000 meters elevation to 2.5. So that's good altitude. Like, yeah, it's a good hard day out. So, you know, I think that's a training day. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, yeah. And you're, Ella, how old are you?
She's 21.
21. So your 21-year-old teammate put you away because you dropped your phone.
I know, like amateur mistake.
Maybe the most gravel racing thing I've heard in a while.
Because typically you wouldn't take a phone in a race, but, you know, yeah, we came and we were meant to have fun, and then the put the number on and, yeah, yeah, you can't hold us back.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know it was an amateur mistake, but, yeah, Ella's strong. You know, she's obviously come through the Zwift Academy, so who knew she could be good on the gravel when she spent time on indoor trainer. But no, she's actually been pretty impressive in her first season with the team, and yeah.
So talk to me about the Zwift Academy. Break that down for people.
So basically, Zwift Academy, Zwift came to the team and had this idea. So obviously, people that don't know Zwift, it's an online training tool where you can go in there virtually, put your bike in a trainer. You can either challenge yourself, so you see a course, or sometimes they have some places, like they have the Ride London course, they have some course in New York, which want championships. So you can go there, just ride if you want, but you can also ride virtually with anybody in the world. So I've been in there and I've seen my friend Michael Matthews on there, and we've trained together per se, you know, virtually, and we can have every Tom, Dick and Harry could come join us too and join our ride. Or you got your Strava segments, like your sprints. They do like e-racing now as well. They do, you know, just rides, like weekly bunch rides on the Zwift. So it's a pretty cool interactive thing for people that are either in places with bad weather, people who are scared of the traffic, people that just don't have time and just want a short, fast, efficient workout. So that's how Zwift came about. And then the Academy is, what they want to do was create a platform for people to try and get into cycling that maybe didn't have the opportunity or didn't have the pathways through, you know, where they're from. And from the first year to where we're at now with year three, it's taken a bit of time to get the program perfect, because the first year we had, so they just did everything on the trainer, which is great, but typically you'll find it's more older athletes and much stronger than perhaps your younger ones. And so it's a talent search program, so ideally we want someone who's young who can have a future within the sport. And that's not, no disrespect to Leah, who was our first winner, like she was obviously a huge engine, but she was kind of late 30s, close to her 40s, and so, you know, you're at the end of your career already at that age, and to teach someone some of the basic skills and race tactic, race knowledge is quite difficult. But, you know, it gave her the opportunity to see the world of cycling. She did 2 years with the team and we could help teach her a lot. But, you know, then they realized, okay, we need to do it a bit differently. So then they did a mix of, everyone could enter, do the workouts to start with, so it's an 8-week challenge, and then as it got closer you had to do some real life stuff on the road, show some results in races if you did any real life racing as well. And then from there, we're down to three. They come to our training camp, and then we kind of suss them out and see who's the best fit for the team. So in year two, we had Tanja Erath, a German girl, and she, you know, huge amount of power. And we already saw a big improvement from Leah to Tanja, for example. So Tanja had done like fixed wheel racing and everything like that. So, you know, she had a bit of race knowledge, but then we could also teach her so much. And now so we have Ella, you know, she's 21 from New Zealand. So I see a lot for myself with her of pathways, because when you're from that side of the world, it's very hard to get to Europe, you know, unless you have a good federation program or you take the plunge and say, okay, I'm going to fly halfway across the world, away from my family and friends, and just try this cycling business. And yeah, it's either good or you fail and you go home and you crack and hang up the bike. So I think it's pretty cool for that, because that's ultimately how we want the Zwift Academy to be. Someone young that we can nurture, teach them, they can learn from, like, obviously a team like Canyon SRAM, where you got some incredible riders, a huge amount of knowledge, and then hopefully give them a pathway into professional cycling.
Yeah.
So that's kind of like how the Academy works.
Yeah, that's amazing. And so is just one ride awarded each year?
Exactly.
Wow. Yeah. I'd love to get you on the mic over here, but Ella's busy doing schoolwork. That's such an interesting concept. It's really cool. Yeah. If it works, like you're saying, and exactly, it seems to be working thus far.
And it's about just finding that one diamond in the rough, per se, you know, like there's obviously so many people with amazing abilities but might not have these pathways or want to get into it but don't know how, and this is their chance. Like, you know, at the moment, it's this year, it's 6,000, 8,000 women have signed up. Yeah, so it's pretty crazy. And, you know, for this one spot, and then it gets down top 10. But it's also, it's not only just for the spot, it's also encouraging women. You know, some people sign up just because they want a challenge. And just getting more people on bikes, more women on bikes. And that's also what we want. We want to inspire and be like, we want to give them a platform, something that they can go with, you know, online with 5,000, 8,000 other women. And, you know, it's a community as well, like an online community. So then also they might meet their people, you know, in real life eventually. But yeah. So it's just about building community and, you know, again, inspiring and then giving opportunity.
Yeah. So now that Elle has made it out of those 5,000 to 8,000, the diamond in the rough has been found. Do you, as someone who has had a lot of results in your day and has a lot of experience, do you feel, how much obligation do you feel to help a young rider such as Ella develop all of those nuanced skills to actually become a race winner and not only have the engine?
Yeah, I think it's, in my position, pretty cool because it's taken a while before I've been able to embrace this position more, I guess, because, you know, I've been one of the more experienced riders on the team for a few years, but I still in my head feel like I'm still one of the young ones. But then I remember...
You're 31.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I know plenty of professional women cyclists that are friends of mine that didn't start winning races until they were 32, 33. Yeah,
it's crazy.
So it's funny that I forget what article it was, maybe Cycling News, and they were interviewing you about your time after cycling.
Yeah.
And I was like, guys, she's 30.
Yeah.
Like, she's got so many. She's just now getting into her prime. But
Exactly.
I thought that was kind of funny.
Yeah, I know. But I'm like, but in my head, I guess I've been racing for what, 17 years or something.
Right.
So, being along. But then as I said, I put myself back in, you know, Ella's shoes, or like, we've got quite a few young riders now within the team. She's actually going to be from the Colorado Classic because I have calling at the kids, you know, because there are all our young ones that are coming out here. And so I'm actually really enjoying and embracing that position because often these days, okay, I'm not getting quite as many results as what I was perhaps, you know, a few years back, but I guess my role's changed, you know, and also the level of the racing's also stepped up. So it's much harder to get those results, but I'm often being the road captain. So like kind of teaching and being the tactician on the road, you know, giving my knowledge within the team and making the plans. But then also when the young riders come to me and kind of ask for advice and kind of want it, then I appreciate that. And then obviously I want to share it because, as I said, when I was 10 years ago, had the likes of top Australian riders like Sarah Carrigan, Olympic champion 2004, and Anoni Wood, who was one of our top Australian riders. You know, I just got to race with Judith Arndt in her final year, who was like obviously an incredible, phenomenal rider. You know, and I learned so much from them. They helped me become the rider that I am today. So, you know, if you can just give like a small percentage of the knowledge, for sure it's going to, if they want it, it'll help them. And, you know, if I can share those experiences, then it's pretty cool as well and see them grow.
Yeah.
It's kind of cool.
Yeah. And speaking of identifying talent, you kind of, in some ways, you went through a similar scenario from what I heard just on the panel discussion when we were up on Saturday. Talk to me about how you got into cycling, because it's a fairly unusual route. Basically, you were just identified in school.
Yeah.
And like, hey, you should try this.
Exactly. So, you know, I like to say cycling found me because I'm always very, very sporty. I did ballet when I was younger. I played basketball for many years.
Basketball?
Yeah.
That's something we haven't got.
Nice. It's cool. Yeah. So that was the main sport in my family. And then... yeah, it's just, you know, we did fitness tests at school, like just shuttle run, 20-meter sprint, vertical jump, your height, you know, just a few basic things which they can say, okay, if you're over 200 centimeters tall, you could be a good volleyball player. Or if you can go over 10 or something in the shuttle run, then you've got good endurance, so you can be a good cyclist. I'm guessing that's why it was. It's literally, they look at these very basic markers and say, okay, these people could potentially be good at these sports. Sports that they perhaps were lacking in participation with young kids, and then want to get more of them into the sports. And it was always like Olympic programs. So, you know, for me, the target was 2008 Beijing Olympics, which was perhaps a bit ambitious with cycling, but, you know.
For track?
Anything. But anything. That was their kind of aim. So I started in, 2002. So it's a pathway. Then they've done other things like Dirt Road to London for, again, group mountain bikers. So, but it's a talent search program. So they look for people who've got these things. So for me, it was this, you know, physical ability. Said, all right, would you like to come out cycling, come out to the velodrome on these dates and come and try? So I did that. Here's a bike, track bike, you know, no brakes, nothing, ride around this velodrome. You walk in there and they're pretty daunting. Like the slopes and the bankings are high.
So steep at first. I remember the first time I rode a track, I was like, how's the bike supposed to stay on
there? Exactly. And they're like, if you go too slow, you'll slide. If you do this or that, I was like, So
I thought this was just pedaling.
Yeah, exactly. So I did that a couple of times and they put me in the lab for a VO2 max test to get a bit more numbers on me, and then apparently I had the ability or what they need for cycling. And so then it's me and I think about 10 or 12 other kids from different schools where, you know, we had this program, so we'd go a couple times.
Only 10 or 12 total?
Yeah, something like that for each group. So yeah,
that's really elite.
So, yeah, So pretty cool. So they did in each state, and South Australia, where I'm from, they've always been one of the big ones for the Talent Search program. So yeah, very lucky with that, like, because, you know, I would never expect to find the sport and, you know, start on the velodrome, and then we learn all the basic skills.
Did you get transferred to, how old were you?
12.
12. And so did you go to a different kind of school?
Mm-mm.
Same
so,
school?
Yeah. So okay. With us, with school is always education, sport, there's all this extracurricular. Yeah. Things like America where you'll go to school for your sport. Like, there's a few schools you can get sporting scholarships, but, you know, we definitely have the separation where our after-school sports is different. It's what you do after school or on the weekends or everything else.
Mm.
You can do it within school, but, yeah, this was just a thing that I would always do after school. So, so did that, and it would be have a couple of training sessions a week. So I'd go down to the velodrome and you learn all the basic skills, learn how to ride the track. And then we eventually then went onto the road, and like on the weekends we'd do on a Sunday, like a training session on the road. And yeah. So it was funny though, because it didn't click with me straight away. Like, I didn't actually like it that much. I still very much love basketball. I'd gone from like baggy clothes to suddenly lycra. I was like, what is this? And back then, you know, cycling wasn't cool. You know, no one knew what it was. And, but then I just stuck with it, and bit by bit then went onto the road. My first race, I got a bronze at the state championships. Like, actually, maybe this sport isn't so bad. Mm. And started traveling around the country. And then when I was 16, I first went overseas to Europe. And so that was pretty cool. And I was like, this sport's kind of cool. And then just doors kept opening along the way. But it is a cool, unique program. Like, the British system do something similar through the lottery system with a talent search program. But outside that, I haven't heard of any other countries that really do the same.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, those Australia and Great Britain are two of the strongest cycling countries there are.
And sporting countries in general, yeah, right? They're massive. Sporting, so,
yeah, period, yeah. So it sounds like you were a little bit hesitant at first. Did you ever think about not going that route? Or did you feel like you almost had an obligation because you were given certain gifts?
Yeah, it was kind of weird. Like, I guess I'm someone that's really finds hard to just quit something, to stop. You'll have to take something that's pretty hard before I'll stop it. So I just did it because I was like, sure, why not? Another sport, something to do. Like, I was always a very energetic child, like pretty hyperactive. So I think my parents liked having me do activities. And yeah, I think I just stuck with it because obviously I had the opportunity, and, you know, my parents are also super supportive. So I just did that. But I was also still able to do my other passion with basketball. And then it just got to the point where I started enjoying cycling more and basketball less. So I think I would have given a good year or two anyway and just kept at it. And then I guess just started liking it more and more. And then it just happened, you know. It was never that point where I was like, yes, cycling's got to be my sport.
Yeah.
It just flowed naturally. And it's just always that fun thing that I had on the side outside, you know, my school and everything else that I did. So yeah, it wasn't until probably 2012 where it started to feel a bit more of a job than, well, it's still not really a job, but, you know, more serious, where you have to really be more switched on. Whereas the rest of the time I was just enjoying the adventures that came with it, like the people that I got to meet. I finally got to travel, because when we were younger, like, we didn't travel because my dad was self-employed and mum just had a normal job. So our holidays were down to the south coast or something, like, you know, I barely left the state, let alone the country.
Mm.
So I think that aspect I really enjoyed and just, yeah, just started loving it. And so wasn't a point where I was like, oh, nah, you know, just going to go away. I think good things just kept coming from it that kept me in it.
Yeah. Is that the traveling circus still something that keeps you in love with it?
Definitely. Yeah. Probably more so than other things. Like, there are points now, because, you know, being in the sport for a long time, and there still is a lot of pressure to perform, and, you know, the level gets higher and higher every year with, you know, the professionalism within the women's peloton. And so that side can be hard sometimes, you know, if you're not mentally in a good place. So sometimes it's like, oh, do I really still want to do this sport? But then it's all the other parts I still love so much, you know. So fortunate enough that I'm in a pretty cool team with Canyon SRAM, and we got amazing partners we get to work with that get to do fun things, get to meet people around the world, the community. You know, I've been fortunate enough to meet some pretty amazing people as well from like other sports and just people in general through cycling.
Mm.
And then also seeing the world. Like, I love travel and I love culture and everything, and being a bit of a gypsy. So definitely something that keeps me at it. And I do still just love to ride my bike. So
yeah. Does the travel ever get to you? How many days on the road would you say you have versus at home?
A lot. I don't actually have exact numbers, but to be 10 days in one place or 10 days at home is a long time for me.
Yeah. And you're not tired of that yet?
No, like, I definitely have small periods where I'll be like, okay, if I've done a long stint on the road and particularly in lots of different places, I'm like, all right, I'm ready to go home.
Yeah.
But then I'll be like 10 days and then I'm like bored. I'm like, all right, let's go again somewhere else.
Yeah.
But they're definitely, I guess, when it's everything's built up on top of everything else, like, you know, with you know, if like things aren't going well in the training, everything else, it's like, okay, sometimes it'd be nice to stay in one place, and then I get itchy feet pretty quickly.
Yeah.
So that part hasn't rubbed off yet. But yeah, I definitely, I enjoy having a home base, but then I love the opportunity just to go somewhere, you know, somewhere new to explore.
That's cool. From what I've heard, you kind of have a thing for the cobbles. Is that true?
Yeah. I do enjoy the spring classics and the cobbles,
Yeah. And you won Omloop, right?
Yeah.
Would you, is that one of your more proud results, would you say?
Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Can, I would love to hear the story of how that went down. I think I saw a couple photos. Was it pretty wet that day?
It was freezing. It was cold. It was one of the coldest spring days we've had. Like, it was about, I think it was -2, and then the hottest got was 2 degrees Celsius. Yeah. So, it was, that year we had a very, very cold spring. Like, every race was crazy. Yeah.
So, I would love for you to take us inside that day. Describe what it was like, how the race played out.
Yeah.
How it all came together.
Yeah. It was actually a pretty cool day. It was like, it's funny how, because I've always had a love of the classics, you know, those are the cool ones. At the time, I was with Mitchell and Scott, which they are now, back then it was Orica Greenedge. We had Emmy Johansson within the team, who was obviously, you know, she's been consistently very good on the cobbles. Had another Dutch rider, a different rider who was Dutch, Luce Gonnewijk as well. So it's kind of like, it's always the first race of the season, the first one of the opening of the spring classics. I come back from Australia into there. I'd actually had a few personal things going on at home, which, you know, so that side was quite challenging side. So then when I was on my bike, nothing hurt. You know, that was my release at that time. And I remember going to the race. The preparation into it was probably the worst you could possibly have. Like, you know, I was trying to find somewhere to live. I had all this stuff going on. Get there and...
So, sorry, you're saying your preparation was really bad.
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, I'd been good. Like, my training side was great, but the rest of my life was, like, you know, a huge mess.
Yeah.
So...
Did you go in feeling like you... Like, what were your expectations? Did you think, okay, I can go win? Or was it more like, I have nothing to lose, I'm just going to ride as hard as I can type
thing? I think it was more, I have nothing to lose. And it was more, I was going in there knowing normally we go support Emma or whatever. And but I was just like, for me, is whenever I was at a race or at my bike, I was like, it was my release, my happy place. It was like the, all right, this is what I can still do. And I don't have to think about the mess of my life at the time. And so we went into it, and you normally come off the Aussie summer quite fit. And so we went with a game plan. We knew we could have numbers, and that race, characteristically, this was in the course it was then, because it's changed a couple times now, but it always split. The Coach Trieur would be the first split, and then from there it was just elimination race. And so it goes back to, it was a freezing day. Normally never ever would ride in full thermals, everything, and that day we're like, nah, need thermal tights, a jacket. It was freezing cold, you know, on the start line shaking. It started at the velodrome, actually, the Ghent velodrome. So you'd always
start. Came straight from Aussie summer like that.
Yeah, I'd been maybe a week in Europe.
And it didn't bother you? Just complete flip
just
of
dealt with it, exactly. Yeah, just that's dressed
impressive.
Well. Yeah. So, you know, we went in with a game plan, all right, go as far as possible and then use our numbers, see how it goes. Obviously, the first thing was to look after Emma. We want to light her up on the Coach Trieur, which was always where the first big split happens, because quite a, like, narrow, it's always hectic going in there, because it's a 120 degree turn and then into this climb, gets quite steep at the top, and then from there it's, you know, it's game on. So then go across there onto the Paderberg, so, you know, we want to make it hard for her anyway, it's split. But then it was like a lot of headwind that day, so the race kept coming back together, split, back together, split. So you always have your climbs first and then the cobbles at the end. And so we came off the last cobble sector we had with 20k to go, and there we, I think we still had about 5 riders, so like, well, we're going to use our numbers. So one by one we just attacked.
You had 5 riders left.
Yeah.
Holy shit.
Yeah, exactly. Of like maybe 30, so yeah, we had good numbers. So
good,
we just
place.
Had to, so, you know, never ever did I think I'm the one that's going to win the race. I was like, of course I want to have a great race. And I think I did set it as an early goal, actually, to be, I want to have a good, you know, good target for head news bladders. I wasn't quite ready to target something like Flanders then. And then, you know, one by one, obviously everyone's looking at Emma, but then we attack bit by bit. Got to about 5K to go. Finally, I was like, okay, it's my turn to attack again. And I just went and I looked back and I had a gap. I was like, oh, all right, let's go this. Just kept riding, you know, and then Megan Gagné came across to me. At that time, she was riding for Rabobank, and I wanted it so much that I was probably doing more than what I should have. And I could see behind, you know, we had enough of gap we could hold on, but like I was more doing the doing the turns, but I was just hoping she was playing poker face. And yeah, anyway, like we got to the final and it's quite a slight uphill drag, and I was like, okay, play this smart, like there's a chance, you know, to win. But still, you know, until the point that I started the sprint, and then, you know, she just didn't react. And then when I got the win, it was pretty cool, because obviously it was like the first big classics win, but like I didn't ever expect it, you know. Like I just went in, it was just for me, as I said, it was like my release at that time of like the cycling. And I just felt so strong. I felt invisible, like, you know, nothing hurt. It was just the legs could do everything. And it was one of those cool days where you just felt like amazing on the bike. And when it all came together, it was pretty cool.
Yeah. That's awesome. That's cool. And then what was it like after that? Because I've heard and I know from personal experience that once you have a big success like that, it can be kind of a double-edged sword.
Yeah.
It's what you train and dream of, but then all of a sudden there's a lot of eyes on you. Yeah. And the ruthless mob expect you to do it again almost immediately.
Yeah, exactly. I think initially it wasn't too bad. Like there was never the big pressure, but of course then it suddenly put my name into like the kind of classics type riders. And, you know, as well, some of my biggest results have always come from being able to get into breakaways. You know, like one of the other big results I had was the Giro. I did 100K solo. Like,
wait, what?
Yeah.
You won a Giro stage 100K solo? Yeah.
Again, it was like meant to be a sprint stage. And it was like just after a couple of like hard GC days. And then we went in with a plan. We're like, well, what do we want to do? We don't have a sprinter. Well, let's try for a breakaway. And again, it was one of those bit by bit, 20K. And I'm the one that my attack goes and gets a gap. I was like,
and no one went with you?
No. So I was thinking about, I was like, great, this is going to be a typical long day, going to get caught at the end. Seeing it 2 minutes for age, my director came out to me. I was like, oh, is this right? I go back. He's like, oh, this good. Okay. And it just happened to be that the GC riders and the big teams, they want a rest day. So they're happy for me. As long as I wasn't going to go into the jersey, they'd let me there all day. The Italian teams were Italian, just want to follow all day. Because, you know, on paper, you're like, it's a sprint day, hands down. And then just the gap got bigger and bigger and bigger. I got out to 13 minutes at one point.
13? Yeah, were you crazy. In virtual pink?
Yep. Yeah, then they started chasing. I won by like 7 minutes. So it was like you insane. Still won by yeah. Holy it was insane. Then it suddenly put me back in the top 10 overall. But that was my first big European win. It was the year before.
Wow.
But yeah, after those ones, then it was like a bit hard to get the sneaky breakaways anymore.
Yeah, you're marked like crazy.
Definitely. But then on where after Het Nieuwsblad though, I'd say I just, because I guess I never went on to like win a ton more stuff. Like I was, that year I had a very, very good year, like a lot of top 10s. Few podiums. Like I also had another big result with second in Plouay in the back when it was the World Cup. Mm-hmm. So that was kind of my big, and I think I ended up top 10 at Worlds as well that year. So that was like my first big, you know, kind of, but then after that I changed teams and then, you know, of course then you're a bit more of a name and then for sure it's, you can't race how you used to race, you know, you need to start playing with the big players and stuff like that. And yeah, like anything, you just need to try, get better and work out, you know, how to beat your opponents. And you know, it's not only physical, it's also about having the mental capacity as well and, you know, and having the right team and everything else. So,
yeah. It takes a lot of pieces.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, interesting. Let's talk about not bike racing for a minute. Because I said we were going to also talk about non-bike racing stuff and that was half an hour of bike racing, stuff, which was awesome. But you have interests off the bike, which I very much appreciate and would love to hear about. And you did an interview with Cycling Tips a handful of years ago, where you kind of talked about this struggle of balance a little bit. Talk to me about that, because it sounds like, to me, what I got out of it is, it sounds like you actually have really good balance, maybe, because you like to do a lot of things off the bike, and you chase things off the bike almost as hard as on the bike.
Yeah.
But it sounded like maybe you were talking about that sometimes you struggle with focusing as much as you should on the bike. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. Yeah. So that hits home very much for me. So I would love to hear you talk about that.
Yeah. So, you know, like how I say I struggle with balance, because yes, I like 200,000 things and I love living life and enjoying not only just the racing process, but everything else that cycling gives me, you know, like, because cycling is my life, but I also don't want to be one of these people that I finish and I regret things when I finish, you know, saying no to a bunch of, you know, opportunities of other things, which can be a good and a bad thing. Like, you know, if you're enjoying life, great, but if you want performance and results, that's where it can hinder you sometimes. So for me, it's always been a game of learning how to balance the times of the fun stuff, or, you know, like sponsor things or just hang out with friends, for example, versus the times when you have to say no and be really focused and getting towards that big goal. And for a long time, I guess I was one of those people that was typically not good at saying no. So I'd try to do everything, but then at the end of the day, I'd just run myself down and get to the race, be like, oh, actually, you know, I might be doing everything right on the training side, but the recovery side, I'm not, because I'm
doing harder. What were some of the things that you were saying yes to that were impacting your cycling?
Probably nights out with friends or, you know, like time when, you know, you're living in the south of France, you get invited to have some cool, I don't know, fun experience, and you're like, I know I should be probably at home sleeping, but I actually want to go out for dinner. And then after that, end up going out later than what I should have. Yeah. And, you know, and then it snowballs effect. They're not recovering. They feel guilty. Then you're like, okay, I should train. Mm. Some sponsor things probably at the wrong times, you know, like cool opportunities, but at the same time, great at the time. But then if I go further and say, okay, actually that period it probably wasn't the best time in terms of that's why I wasn't as good at this particular race or something like that. Or, you know, sometimes too much in the off season, traveling, doing a lap of the world in a month. Yeah, I did that twice, 2 years in a row.
Really?
Yeah.
just vacation.
Vacation combined with opportunities, you know.
Yeah.
So I worked in, I was always very good at being, I work in the both. So I'd go, you know, 1 year, where was I? So we had world championships in Richmond. And then my good friend, Evie Stevens, former racer, she got married in Sun Valley, Idaho. In between, I went up to Vancouver because used to be sponsored by Lululemon. So I went to hang out with them. After the wedding, then I went out to Taiwan to this Taiwan Caribbean Challenge thing. Then back to Australia because I had some awards to go to. I was there for like 5 days. And then I had to go to a charity event in London. So I literally land straight from Australia into London, everything from there. You know, went straight to the event that day, everything, then finally back to Europe, to south of France. And yeah. So, you know, awesome fun, but at the same time, you know, when your body's supposed to be recovering from travel and the season, everything, maybe not the best. Well, it'd take me a bit longer to get into the season. So things like that, I guess, you know, anytime I see a cool opportunity, I want to take it. But you sometimes have to look at the big picture and, you know, what your true goals are and things like that. And yeah.
Yeah, that's such a tricky balance.
Completely.
It's tough because there are athletes in the peloton or in my field who are willing to do only cycling and just maximize.
Yeah, and for some of them, it's fine. They can do that and they're happy.
Yeah, and if you want to win or be a consistent winner, you kind of have to do that too. But by the same token, sometimes I think, you know, once I hang it up, how much am I going to regret not doing all of those things that you just mentioned?
Yeah.
Do you ever get pressure from directors or sponsors or that sort of thing for all of that off the bike stuff?
From sponsors, never, because I think a lot of time they're worked in with sponsors and so they love it as well at the same time. From the team sometimes, or more to the point, I get talking to when, you know, you can see I've kind of lost my way a little bit. And sometimes I need that. I get the very firm German talking to, but that's kind of like, all right, pull your head in and, you know, we have you on the team for other reasons than just, you know, obviously representing the brands. Like, I'm on the team obviously because of all the experience I bring and obviously because they know I'm capable of big performances. And that's just why they put the pressure on, because it's like they know what I'm capable of and they don't want to see it wasted. So it's good because I do need that sometimes. But yeah, like I said, I'm someone that always races on mentality. Like, I can do all the training in the world and have all these incredible numbers and everything else that you want to look at, but if my head's not there, I won't race well. Like a lot of people, but some people aren't as emotional racers as others. But for me, if I'm in a happy place, I can do anything. But when I'm, you know, not loving life, then I'll be shit in the race. I'll get there and you just can't push that extra bit that you want. And so that's why I talk about that balancing, because it's just find that perfect equilibrium of the keeping the happy head with all the other stuff without being too much while keeping the performance side. So it's, you know, yeah.
So if you find yourself in one of those ruts, how do you pull yourself out of it?
Sometimes it's easier than others. Normally, I just try to take a step back, get back to basics, whether it's I see why I'm upset, why I'm not loving it, and then work back from there. So if it's because of the bike, it's like, okay, put that away for a couple of days. Don't touch it. Go see my friends. Go hang out. Go do something that I enjoy doing. Go do a different sport. Go for a random weekend trip or something like that. Just go back to doing the things that I know that I like, and then also break down maybe what's the reason why I've, you know, come that way, like whether it's become a big goal, for example. So perfect example is for going to Rio Olympics, like I was trying to get selection for that. And the pressure of that, you know, just ate me up because I went in with a good chance and then, you know, the first race didn't go well, the next one. And I just kept thinking about that way too much. And
the outcome rather than the steps to get there.
Exactly. Yeah. Just being like, well, this was a bad race. That was a bad race. I got no chance. Seeing it go further and further away instead of being like, put that behind, focus on the next one. Got to so much to a point I was in a hole and, you know, so I was like, all right, I was like, let's forget about it. Say it's out the window, but let's just go do what I love doing, riding my bike. So then it was actually in California. We had done two of California. It's like the lowest point. Like I'd been dropped as in, you know, the last group on the road, which ego-wise is pretty crushing.
It's not when you belong.
You know you're much better than that. And finally, it's like, all right. And then I was coming out to Colorado, actually, and up to Aspen for just to do some altitude. And it was perfect. It was just what I need because it's like a new place to explore, somewhere cool. I just had to ride my bike. I was in a beautiful location. And then I was like, okay, this is why I ride my bike again. So it's just kind of remembering why you do the things that you're doing. And then that's the process to getting back out of those ruts, I think, and having good people around you, really supportive people, and letting them in, because I'm pretty good at blocking people out and closing my doors. So
yeah, also important. And you're building towards the 2020 Olympics again,
yeah.
And is your mindset different this time around?
Completely.
I'd
say, because now this will be the third Olympic cycle I'm going through, so like London was a surprise one of being a chance for selection, then obviously just missed out, and then Rio was different because I went in there as one of the greatest chances, and then it was me that I guess made that crumble. Whereas this time around, I feel like all those things I've learned puts me in a much better mindset. Like, and the way that the Australian Federation is now, it's changed as well. Like, I'd say before it was a lot more political with the selections, like most sports and most countries. But now I feel like the way that they look at everything, they're taking riders for the course, you know, who they need, who they feel for the different roles, not just because you got these results. So I know exactly what I need to do, and I've got a good process of how to do it. You know, I've got, you know, great people that I'm working with combined with the team, and then my coach, you know, some close friends around me that keep me happy as well. And I guess I'm just a lot more content with the role that I'm playing within the team and what I need to do in races, and being like consistently happy this year. And, you know, I've got that love for the racing back again. So then all that I think is collectively going to help with the process of hopefully getting to Tokyo, because it's, you know, the one thing that's missing is an Olympics, you know, in my career, and something that I really want to do. So, you know, I've seen the course of being out there last year. I'm going to go out again in this off season, so I can really be prepared mentally, and then it comes down to me. And but I think I have a lot more direction than in the past, and I'm just not going to let the pressure and just be like, okay, I know what I have to do, let's focus on these targets and take the steps you need to do,
right.
You know, and if the first target doesn't work, wash it away, focus on the next one. And
did you get some like mindset coaching help to get to that point, or is it just your own experiences that help get you there?
I worked with a psychiatrist in that 2016 year, actually, just a bit, but a lot of it I've kind of learnt myself, and also just talking with other people, and particularly other athletes. You know, as I said, I've been fortunate enough to be associated with many other top athletes and successful athletes, so you kind of learn from each other, I think, and you can take different things, and you can also talk about things too. You know, it's like some of my best friends are in sport but not in cycling, so you know, you can relate at the same level but also talk about everything so openly without the whole, oh, you know, how sometimes people want to be a bit secretive, or you know, like, I don't know, cyclists can be weird sometimes.
Very, very.
So
actually, speaking of that, I would love for you to take us inside the Pro Peloton. I'm sure it's incredibly diverse depending on the country and the teams involved and the race and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
I have plenty of friends in the pro men's peloton, a couple in the women's, but not as many. Yeah. What is the dynamic like? Because on the men's side, it's pretty hostile a lot of times. I mean, people there are there to do a job. Yeah. It's very dangerous.
Yeah.
Very. I think cycling, road cycling, people say mountain biking is scary and dangerous. It's not even close to road cycling.
Yeah.
I have to assume it's the same.
Yeah, definitely. On the women's side, I'd say it's probably a little bit more open. You know, like, people aren't so cutthroat. And I think they're a little bit more supportive, more willing to help each other. But at the same time, you know, people still like their own little quirks. You know, it's like, if I'm doing this training, I'm doing this training, but I'm not going to tell you what I'm going to do, type thing. Mm. Or, and then the different nationalities are always interesting. You know, like, we're lucky with Canyon Tram because we have so many nationalities. So everyone's got their own quirks and differences, and people deal with things in different ways. You know, you might get, like, Germans are very direct. You know where you stand with them straight away. Like, they do not sugarcoat anything. Whereas, like, Aussies, we're pretty chilled, you know, we're willing to be like, oh yeah, I'll help you, you know, no worries kind of approach. But, you know, when it comes to the top, for sure, people, you know, don't want to give away their game all the time, or everyone kind of has their own little kind of circles. And yeah, so it is a bit like the men, but I say just not quite as nice. I think we're a bit more open and friendly with each other and our competitors sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is there any like really strong rivalries in the group? Like, if there's, are there ever grudges held? Like, if you end up in a move with someone,
yeah,
are there any backstories that
Oh, for sure. Like, yeah. There's definitely the girls in the peloton that people don't like and people do like, you know. I don't know if it'll come down to, like, if it's a breakaway, you're not going to work with them. But then again, there could be, you know, there's plenty of those inner rivalries. But it's funny, too, how you can, before you're teammates with them, you think they're a completely different person than your teammates. Because I've got a perfect example with Barbara Grischi, who was my teammate before. You know, she's a crazy Italian sprinter. And I've had to sprint against her many times. And, you know, she can be quite erratic in the bunch. Everybody knows that. And depends how panicky she is. Like, so I was like, you know, before I met her, I was like, oh, no, I don't like her. You know, she's always putting me off the road and I'm one to fight back. I won't take that. And then we became teammates. I'm like, oh, how's this going to be? And now, you know, you get to be teammates. She's a lovely person. And like you judge someone how they're on a bike versus a person. And then I was like, oh, actually, you're better to be teammates with them again. Because, you know, we often did sprints together where I led her out or she led me out. And we're as good bike handlers as each other, so we could go through the crazy gaps. But, you know, sometimes when I was behind, I was like, okay, I'm just close my eyes and go through the mess she creates. But so that's an example of something like that. But definitely there's big Dutch rivalries. I'd say I've heard on the grapevine, you know, say like between Anna van der Breggen and Annemiek van Vleuten. So, you know, they will work together. But like say when van der Breggen won the second last stage of the Giro, you know, it's kind of like, yeah. It's quite satisfying over Annemiek versus things like that.
Interesting.
Yeah. And then obviously, you know, there's like Kirsten Wild is obviously one of the sprinters that she likes to pick on the little riders for sure.
Oh, really?
Again, like, you know, she's got a good heart off the bike because, you know, she can push herself around when she wants and she is kind of boss when she wants and because she's obviously one of the fastest sprinters and, you know, I've had many run-ins with her. But when you finally fight back, then it's like, all right, bit of mutual respect. But because she knows she can push people out the way, she'll do it. And that's the thing. Like with most people, like if you know riders that you can push away, you're going to do it.
Yeah.
So it's like why you got to always teach the young ones, hold your space. So it is interesting. There's definitely different dynamics. And, you know, you'll have one person will say, I hate that person versus the next person will like them. So it's very individualized, but people have different reasons. Normally it'll be either internationality battles, I'd say, or just race battles, you know, either always going against that person, knowing like they'll just play the poker game or not work with you or whatever else. But
fair enough. Okay, let's go back to non-bike stuff again real quick. You have an interest in fashion.
Yep.
You started your own brand. You're doing some work with Rafa, designing your own stuff. What other sort of off the bike interest do you have? Because I think it was a Cycling News article I read about your plans for post-career.
Yep.
Some of your interests are a coffee shop.
Yeah, like everyone.
Maybe leading like higher-end bike tours.
Yep.
Or
just niche bespoke travel.
Yeah.
Like all crazy adventures. Like basically, I want to do all these things. And
describe for me what sort of adventures you'd have in mind. Like Lachlan Morton craziness? No,
this is non-cycling related. This is like, you know, like take a helicopter to a private island, like in the remote middle of nowhere and like do like, you know, quad biking or snowmobiling. Like I love to do all these other crazy things too. Like the cycling stuff fun too. Like, you know, yeah, sure, adventure riding or cool mountain biking, but like heli mountain biking, love something like that. Just basically, you know, everyone's into adventure these days and I'm always looking for where's somewhere cool that's different, that's not, you know, your typical, but always has fun things that's adrenaline pumping, you know, like one of my dreams, I'd love to go on like a fighter jet, for example, you know, that's on my bucket list. And just so, you know, I'm living in an area where there's obviously a lot of wealth and stuff like that. And so I'm like, well, and I saw someone that created something similar of this niche bespoke travel because people want, they don't have the time to plan, but they want these out of the world experiences. And through the people I've met through my racing, I think that'd be cool. And you could do from the cycling side, you know, the corporate say, oh, I can meet you, introduce you to whoever, like Sagan, Froomey, whatever, you know, some of the guys who maybe I've got to know throughout my career, or then be like, oh, flip side, oh, I can create this awesome trip, you know, just tell me what you want and I'll create it. And then I have to try it out. That's the goal, because basically I probably don't have the money to do it, but I want to do all these fun things. So I'm like, well, how can I do that and then make money out of it? And then you just need a few cool clients, good money, and then Bob's your uncle.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's like one side. But, yeah, no, the coffee shop, always love coffee. Whenever I'm traveling anywhere, I'm like, search for the best coffee shop, you know.
What's the best one here, actually? Because I need to go do some work after this.
Oh, yeah, I went Big Iron Coffee Co. Yeah? It's just in town. That's one I've been every day pretty much. So nice. It's like not full top hipster style, but it's pretty good for a mountain town.
Yeah.
So definitely I like to have a coffee machine at home and stuff. So I do enjoy that. Then got involved with a beer company as well, a craft beer company.
Oh, yeah, let's talk about that.
That's in the South Front. So that was just like a fun project. It just came about. Again, it's one of these things that, you know, you meet people. Again, it came through sport. You know, I've been fortunate enough to meet great people. These people wanted to start. Same concept as Bolter Brewing in Australia, which is done by a bunch of surfers, where it's like a passion project where they're like, hey, we want to have a beer brand and utilize their profiles to then, you know, help with promotion and then also create great beer. Like, you know, I'm not a massive beer drinker, if I'm honest, but, you know, I love the idea of it. And, you know, obviously being in the Australian culture, and it came to me, I was like, oh, that's super cool. And we're fortunate we have like a, you know, there's a couple of F1 drivers involved. So like Daniel Ricciardo is one of our big ones. Jenson Button, who's now retired from F1, but, you know, huge profiles. Obviously love beer culture as well. We got Andreas Mikkelsen, who's a rally car driver. Tor Hushov.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, you know, another bike rider.
What is he up to these days?
He's still riding. He's still like super fit and in shape. He's doing, you know, little, he's just a bit everywhere. Like, you know, he's also smart with his career in terms of like a few business opportunities, but does some bike riding tours, stuff like that. I think he does some commentary. I see him every so often. Like, he's still living around the area, but yeah, seems like he's keeping busy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, so kind of that, and I was like, well, that sounds cool, you know, bunch of cool sports people that we get to mingle with. And then we got a brewer from Sweden that does all the brews and there. So it's like kind of started slow because the south of France, the culture's slowly picking up the craft brewing, but we're like the first to do it. So that was the goal, be the first and see it grow. So yeah, so it's cool. It's like, it's something more fun than anything. But again, it's, you know, one of these things, like good side project that, you know, because obviously cycling will finish eventually. So if you can put, you know, some of your money somewhere and hopefully make something out of it, yeah, it's also good to like set yourself up and open doors, you know. Mm-hmm. Been very fortunate to have a few different opportunities, different to that, but, you know, opportunities from meeting people from where I'm living, which, yeah. So, nice. Yeah, always. I'm always a scatterbrain of, always have 101 things I want to do when I finish, but, you know, let's see. Just be a, you know, a gravel racer maybe. Brand ambassador, go around all the fun events. Yeah, you know.
Especially if you have Zabel to help tow you back up and you drop your phone.
Yeah, exactly. My personal domestique. I was like, Tim, I was like, how's it feel being the one in the wind instead of being sitting on these days?
Yeah. He used to have to push wind literally for 200 meters.
Exactly. Exactly.
Laziest bike racer ever. Yeah, just exactly. Kidding. Just
kidding.
So let's talk about fashion for a minute.
Yeah.
What's some of the stuff you've done in terms of designing apparel?
Yeah, so with fashion, so basically I studied fashion when I finished school. That was, it's always been a passion of mine, you know, like I love seeing the latest trends and design and style and everything like that. And so then I started studying it, but I couldn't finish it because I started traveling overseas. So it was very difficult to do, you know, such a hands-on thing. So from what I learned out of that, I decided, I was like, all right, I'll try and do my own brand, you know, with cycling apparel, because obviously it's an area that I know. And at the time back then, like, there was zero women's stuff, like nice looking stuff. And funny though, when I look back, because the style I had then versus now was completely different. It was very, very young style. Like, it was cool, it was fun, it was playful, but at the same time I look back, it's like, really?
A little out there.
Yeah. Or just, you know, yeah, just going against all the typical cycling fashion rules. But yeah, so then I've been fortunate enough. I did a few other collections since then, but then did a few like freelance projects. You know, people come to me and I do some designs for them. Like, we have a charity ride every year from Saint-Tropez to Monaco for, it's called the Champagne Oyster Cycling Club.
Ooh, sounds
AKA the Cock. Nice. Just for something fun. So I designed their stuff then, but, you know, it's great because for charity, it's for the Princess Charlene Foundation, things like this. So that was always a fun one to be involved with, but a tricky one to do nicely because we had a bunch of sponsors we had to put on there. I've worked with this women's cycling club in Yorkshire, actually. It's like a women's only that they started from this one woman that just wanted some other women to ride with. It's actually Lizzie Dignan's sister, who, she's a big part of it. And Lizzie was like, hey, can you design the kit? I was like, sure, why not? And so that was cool. So I designed them a kit and they love it, and because they obviously have their own personal thing. And for me, it's actually really cool to follow them because they're a very, very inspiring group of women, you know, of all sizes, all abilities. They go in rain, hail, and shine, and what they do, like, it's incredible. And, like, they think, you know, obviously it's cool because I'll see them, I like tour to Yorkshire and stuff and cool support, but at the same time, like, I don't think they realize how much, like, motivation, inspiration I get just from seeing what they're doing.
Yeah.
So those cool things. Then since trying to do the Tiffany Jane stuff was a bit tricky because, you know, I'm a perfectionist and want to do it properly, but while I'm racing is, you know,
it's a huge undertaking. Exactly. I can't imagine.
Exactly. So not able to do it. So then I came with a different approach. I was like, well, I get to work with all these awesome brands through racing. maybe I approach them and do collaboration projects. So the first one was with Veloccio, actually, when we were Veloccio SRAM. So Christy gave me the opportunity to do a collaboration project with them. So that was really cool. I did like, it's like an origami design. It's like, again, my designs like to be playful, you know, wanted to be, look attractive, you know, like sort of slimming, you know, in all the right places, all things, you know, that women are kind of self-conscious about and stuff that's flattering to wear. So I did that and that was super cool. But then we, I was signed with Canyon SRAM and then we had Rafa involved. And then from early on straight away, obviously they wanted to do more with us. And I was like, got straight to the point. I was like, hey, I'd love to do something together.
Yeah.
And so that was super cool. And we did this capsule collection, Ode to the Sun, where I got to work with their design team on it. And like they've got some incredible designers and it was really cool. You know, like that one was based upon, you know, the sunrise and the sunset and something I'm fascinated with. And, you know, obviously as professionals, we're rarely seeing the sunrise because unless you're doing a gravel race, you don't normally get up to see the sunrise. So, but it's something that's so special. Like when you make that time to see it and like, you know, when everyone's asleep. So that's how that was based. And that was really cool. And so it's something I would love to do more, definitely do some more stuff with Rafa. It's just, you know, bit by bit. And it's also something I've thought about in the future, like another opportunity that could potentially transition into is go out and work on their design team and that aspect. Because I also was lucky enough too when we were with Lululemon, actually I went out to Vancouver to work on, they were trying to do cycling kit at one point a few years back and got to work with their design team a little bit. So that was really cool. Nice. As well, you know, because obviously they're a wicked brand and do some really fun stuff. And you know, just to see their space and having these opportunities, you know, to see these big brands and how they work from the design side and everything is pretty cool.
Yeah, that is cool. Okay, one of my last questions. I'm curious about what you would like to see in terms of progress or change or that sort of thing regarding women's cycling. And one thing that kind of annoys me, tell me if I'm off here, but people seem to always caveat. So there's cycling,
yeah,
which is like men's cycling, and then there's women's cycling. It's like, no, they're all cycling.
Yeah, exactly.
And especially at a gravel race where we're all here racing together. By the way, what is her name? The woman who won yesterday, Brody. On TIBCO. Yeah. Yesterday, I look over and finally the selections are starting to be made. Mile 90.
Yeah.
There's like 18 of us left and we're all hurting. Ted, Colin, me, we're all like, okay, it's about to be four of us.
Yeah.
She's still there.
Yeah. She's pretty strong.
Really strong. And I don't think people realize like how fucking good you guys are.
Yeah.
Like you're so good.
Yeah.
And so... One thing I would like to see, just from an outsider's perspective, and I don't have the same perspective you're going to have, obviously, as a woman, but is somehow being able to tell that story that the difference in terms of speed of these races is very minuscule, and like the fact that you are racing on the Paterberg and these cobbles and all that sort of thing. I don't think many amateur cyclists realize how hard it is to ride those courses, period.
Yeah.
Like most cyclists couldn't even get over the Paterberg.
Yeah,
sure. So I think that's one area that there could be progress, is like telling the story of actually how good
definitely
you guys are.
Yeah. But
anyway, I'd be curious to hear what other ideas you have.
Yeah, like, you know, obviously it's in a big period of change at the moment. It's like there is a big, you know, emphasis on trying to see, you know, show exactly, I just say, like, we're a bunch of strong women as well, like, you know. And things like the gravel race essay is a perfect example of that, because, you know, you throw us in with the boys, we are capable. Like, I'd say road cycling is completely different because it's got so many more different elements to it, you know. Mm. Got your tactics, you know, men naturally are always going to be stronger because of testosterone and things like that, but women can still hang in there for a long time. And you're seeing, like, again, Annemiek van Vleuten is a perfect example. Like, we've seen comparisons before on, like, the course a couple of years ago when it finished on Col d'Izard, like her time versus the men's time. She's in the top 10 of the men.
That's crazy. And
yeah. So it's like, you know, I think, as you say, highlighting that is pretty cool, because people don't realize, like, we're more than capable and, you know, strong in our own ways. But at the same time, they need to stop comparing men and women's cycling on the roadside. Like, as I say, the gravel, the mountain bike, CX, I'd say is a lot more even, a lot more comparable, because you're doing a lot more similar kind of races and everything. Whereas the road, as you say, like, I want people to stop trying to say we need to ride longer, we need like a 3-week Tour de France, we need this. It's like, I don't believe that's a future. For me, the exciting is the short races. We see it with the men's races. 100K is like the best races ever to watch. You know, our races, as soon as we've gone from that 140 to 160K branch, they're not as exciting. Like, it takes longer to get going versus we go 100 to 140 and it's still great. Mm. And it's fascinating. And like, it doesn't need to be longer to be for equality, you know, and those sorts of things.
Almost like an opportunity for y'all that the races are shorter.
Exactly.
I feel like if a race is more exciting, it's more exciting. I remember hearing from some folks at Red Bull recently that the women's World Cups on Red Bull TV often have way better viewership than the men's because it's less predictable. Right now there's 10 or 12 women that could win a World Cup on any given day. And on the men's side, there's two, maybe three.
Yeah, definitely. Like, I think it's the future. And so, you know, I'd love to see progress in that area because it's like, you know, everyone talks about equality, but it's like, what is equality? It's right, like, it's not saying we have to race the same distances. Like, you know, it's
equal opportunity.
Exactly. And creating like a fun, exciting sport in the world where attention spans are so short, you need to be more extra packed for people to want to watch it. So, and just a greater presence on TV and stuff like that, because that's also what's always lacking. It's still talked about. It's getting better, but still plenty of races aren't doing a good enough job. And, you know, they can obviously do it pretty well with the men. And it's like, I'd love to see more progress in that, just to really be able to showcase our sport and how beautiful it is and how cool the racing is, because so many people are knowing it, but they want to see it. So I'd love to see that. And yeah, like, everything's moving in the right direction. It's just a very glacial pace, you know.
Yeah.
As like we talk about, like, the gaps and everything else, you know, we get a small celebration. It's like, woo, we get like live streaming, you know, that should be the norm now. Or it's, you know, how we always talk about the money within the sport. Like, we talk about, you know, Sky can get 35 million, yet, you know, women's teams believe they only need to run on 2 million. Like, why is that? You know, those sorts of questions should be asked. You know, why don't we pitch ourselves higher, and why don't companies and brands look at the opportunities that lay there? Because, you know, it's in the world at the moment, it's in that kind of time where everyone wants to show these differences, create these different opportunities, and inspire the younger generations. And, you know, if they can strive and say, we don't always have to fight just because we're girls, that we deserve this, it should be the norm. So I'd like to see, you know, more of that change of just things becoming the norm, not we need this because it's women's cycling, or because we're girls or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I'd like to see that mostly.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Yeah.
Ella,
yeah.
Would you mind getting a photo for when I post this?
Yeah, sure.
And then also, there may be a fan question for you. Maybe.
Oh yeah.
Let's see if she. She said she was going to get me one. She didn't make it in time. Oh well. That's okay.
Well, we can say hey.
There was a. There's. So I'm from Austin, Texas, originally, and there's
a very Texas accent.
Sorry?
You don't have a very Texas accent.
I know, I wish. I loved all the howdies and y'alls that y'all were throwing. I'll use the words, but I don't really have the accent, unfortunately. I would love to have one. There was that girl also on the panel, Casey Armstrong, who has a pretty good Tennessee accent.
Oh, yeah.
And
yeah.
I think I leaned over to Amity. I was like, oh, I would kill for that accent. Anyway, there was this young woman from Austin that I know who's just an enthusiast cyclist, and I saw that she followed you, and I thought it would be fun to have her ask you a question, but didn't quite get it to her in time, but that's okay.
Next time.
Yeah. Awesome. Well, is there anything else you wanted to talk about? I took an hour of your time. Thank you so much.
We covered lots. Pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you all for tuning in. And thank you, SRAM, for being presenting partner of this show and for all of our shows in December. Thank you also, SRAM, for being such a supporter of cycling across the board, whether it's this podcast, whether it's being title sponsor of Tiffany Cromwell's Canyon SRAM team, whether it's supporting and founding World Bicycle Relief, one of the most incredible nonprofits I think there is. That's something we haven't really talked about yet. I would love to have a guest on the show that's an expert on World Bicycle Relief. Maybe I'll hit up SRAM about that next. Thank you, SRAM, for just wanting to see the sport grow and thrive across the board, no matter what your experience with the bike is. I think that's what it's all about, and that's definitely one of our goals on this show. Even if it's not bike specific, just get out there, push yourself, enjoy the outdoors, and the world will be better for it. If y'all would like to support the show as well. You can go to patreon.com/theadventurestash. That's patreon.com/theadventurestash. And there, if you commit $10 or more a month, we'll send you for free one of our OG logo t-shirts. It's the only way to get your hands on one these days. We don't sell them anymore, but we would love to send you one as a thank you for supporting the show. And all proceeds from that Patreon page go to Lily's paycheck. Lily is the one that edits and produces this show every week, takes out many of my blunders. Thanks for that, Lil. Please subscribe to the show. Please rate and review the show. 5 stars goes a long way. Thank you all for listening. I will catch you next week.